spotlighting the olfactor in soil genesis, an expanded biomantle approach. We acknowledge all who have contributed to what we present here, especially Charles Darwin, James Thorpe, Francis Hoel, and Jeff Humphreys, recently deceased, unfortunately. The olfactor needs expansion in terms of process. This paper is a step in that direction. As a starting point, we integrate James Thorpe's biomantle concept with Darwin's bioturbation work, recast as expanded biomantle principles. Our purpose is fourfold: to overview the soil contributions of two giants, Darwin and Dokuchaev, to summarize bioturbation and biomantle principles, to link biomantle and biofabric ideas with the pedosphere and the Earth's critical zone concepts, and to show how these ideas solve problems in the real world. Darwin and Dokuchaev. The left photo shows Darwin the year he wrote his book, his soils book, The Formation of Vegetable Mold, in 1881. And the right photo shows Dokuchaev in the middle with the big beard, surrounded by his students and colleagues, some years after he wrote Russian Chernozem in 1883. The images convey that whereas Darwin worked alone on soil formation, Dokuchaev had quite a gallery of help. Darwin and Dokuchaev made important, though very different, soil contributions, mainly by their books. Darwin's was on soil processes, or bioturbation, which we've heard quite a bit of today, whereas Dokuchaev's was on soil factors, or landscape context. And we also have seen, I think in every paper, references to that model. Dokuchaev's approach, updated by Yeni in 1941, was guiding theory during the 20th century. The olfactor did not and does not, however, emphasize process. Darwin's book was on soil processes, specifically animal bioturbations, which the last speaker talked about quite a bit. And it was based on intuition and long-term experimental observations beginning prior to 1837 and lasting until 1881, 44 years. Dokuchaev's model provided a means to map, classify, and evaluate soils, and also establish chronosequences, which we've seen today as well. Darwin's model lacked such means, mainly for this reason. Darwin's bioturbation principles languished in a five-factors shadow. Now, Darwin studied biomantles that were two-layered. And this diagram pretty much represents the sum of his 44 years' work. And it shows that in this stone layer, there are clasts that were originally part of the parent material, shown as white clasts, but also there are cinders and marl that he dumped on top of the soil many years previously. He did this several times in the course of his career, and then would dig pits in his pastures to see what happened to the stuff that he spread on the surface. And the result was that it migrated down under gravity, and because the animals, in his case worms, but many other animals, invertebrates, were operating in his soil, but mainly worms, were bringing fines to the surface, and you've all seen that, we've all seen it, allowing the coarse fraction to gradually settle down to create a stone line or stone layer. So all the particles that did not fit through worm burrows ended up concentrated in the stone layer. Darwin's research question was, why are Roman coins and other artifacts, once at the surface, now found at depth, often in a layer with stones? And I think I've talked about this. Darwin's views were gained from 44 years of soil work. or animals, and this is the crux of what he studied, although he didn't use these terms and these concepts. He used just plain English. Animals biomix, biotransfer, and biosort soil materials in the soil forming process. That was his message used, given in other words. And this diagram is from his 1881 book. This very busy diagram, I can't, because of time, I can only spend a moment on it, but basically what this diagram represents is the sum total of Darwin's process work. Animal bioturbations, biomixing, biotransfers, and biosorting. If you start out with parent material that is heterogeneous, large clasts and fine fraction, or fine fraction only, as in loess or sand, or you can start with stratified materials. Again, stratified loess or sand. It doesn't make any difference. What does make the difference is the dominant bioturbator that operates on that system. And depending on whether it's an invertebrate, in the style of invertebrate bioturbation, or whether it's a small vertebrate, or whether it's a large vertebrate, the result is you always get either a two-layered anisotropic biomantle or a one-layered isotropic biomantle. We've copied the diagrams that are left there on the projector, so if anyone wants a copy of this diagram, which is very, very busy, please come up and get it after the talk. Integrating biomantle principles with the critical zone concept. The pedosphere soil is the planetary interface where the global spheres all interact, and that's shown on the right. We've all seen this diagram or something similar to it in textbooks. What isn't shown and is a very new concept is the Earth's critical zone. And I note that Henry Lin is sitting out there, who's one of the promulgators of the Earth's critical zone. Critical zone is the zone from the top of the canopy to the bottom of the aquifers, and it's where water, nutrients, everything else is cycled. The focus here today is on the very upper part of the pedosphere, which is shown here, on the epidermis of the pedosphere, or the soil, which is the biomantle. And this is a blow-up of the epidermis. Again, biomixing, biosorting, biotransfers, producing, in this case, a two-layered biomantle. This is an actual photograph of a two-layered biomantle. And then if you take a small sample and blow it up, you see what all of you have probably seen many times, and that is visible biofabric. So the concepts range from the very broad to the very small, and even subvisible biofabric. The biomantle is the organic-rich epidermis of soil unique to Earth, produced dominantly by bioturbation, aided by subsidiary processes, and these are the processes that we normally think of in soil formation. The soil-biomantle approach solves long-standing problems. Two most notable are soil stone layers, or stone lines, and Mima mounds. First, we discuss stone layers, and this is a continuation of the talk we gave. We didn't give it, actually. Ed Runge did last year at the Indianapolis SSSA talks. So some of these slides may be the same if any of you attended his talk. A classic two-layered biomantle formed in drift on the Iowan surface in Dodge County, Minnesota. This is a typical and classic two-layered biomantle. The organisms did their thing, produced a stone line, which incidentally is a very important factor in through flow, which the previous speaker talked about. A buried upper Midwest biomantle from my neck of the woods. This shows Peoria loess overlying a Sangamon Yarmouth soil and formed in pre-Illinois and drift. And it shows a two-layered biomantle above a BT, a well-expressed BT horizon. And that's a close-up of it, formerly called the Ferretto Zone in the old language. And the stone layer is right at this, at the figure's feet, and the biomantle is the A and E horizon of that buried soil. Let's go to the Big Sur area of California, and we see in a granite terrain two feeder dikes and a two-layered stone layer, a two-layered biomantle, pardon me, with the quartz clasts forming the lower stone biomantle layer. Another view of a two-layered biomantle just north of the Big Sur in Carmel Valley, California. It's formed in Monterey Shale in a colluvial apron at the foot of a slope. And there is the biomantle, two-layered biomantle. Very nearby, sorry all these examples are from California, but we spent a lot of time out there and they seem to demonstrate a lot of these principles. But what you see here are a whole series of mud flow units coming off the Santa Lucia Mountains, and each one has been bioturbated following Darwin's model into a two-layered biomantle. This is the modern one, and if you look carefully, you'll see one in each one of these mud flows. Each one has been biosorted, and the dominant bioturbator in this case is the Botta pocket gopher, dominant bioturbator. Many other organisms are involved, but the Botta pocket gopher is dominant, and that's important. Stone layers are also linked to the controversial landforms called Mima mounds. In Louisiana and Texas, they're called pimple mounds, prairie mounds, and there's over 30 different names. For mounds formed in gravelly soils, they are simply locally thickened, two-layered biomantles, at least arctic. This is Mima Pit in Mima Prairie, where the name comes from in Thurston County, Washington. What you're seeing is a classic Mima mound terrain. There were millions in Louisiana and Texas and Arkansas and Missouri and Minnesota and Iowa. The inner mound areas show a surface stone pavement, and underneath the mounds is the stone layer. In other words, the stone layer is continuous across the landscape under the mounds and is exposed as a stone pavement in between the mounds. We have lots of data, but we're just gonna show you this. The biomantle, this is a mound sample. Stone layer is here. The stone layer is so thick that it's almost like it's thick. It's well biosorted, but notice there's very large clasts plus fine fraction in the upper part because the dominant bioturbators are pocket gophers and moles, not termites, not worms, not invertebrates, even though all these animals are operating on this landscape as well. It's the dominant bioturbator that the results is what we see from that dominant bioturbator's activity. So stone layers are normal and expected components in most gravelly soils of the world, even in Mima-mounded tracts. Like soil caliche, pans, and other horizons, two-layered and one-layered biomantles follow the topography. Conclusions: the expanded biomantle approach with conceptual roots linked to Darwin, Thorpe, Hull, and many others gives new meaning and explanatory power to the O-factor. Thank you.
All right, we have about 12 minutes for questions, and since Don is here and has just finished presenting here, why don't we allow Don to take a few minutes for questions first, and then we'll go to Tony and then to Karen and Charlie if we get time. Okay. Questions for Don?
Yes.
So for my own work, I thought that the bioturbation, the only way to get it to be, I'm sorry, for the turbation to be spatially non-uniform is to have it be biological, right? So that you have these biota responding versus cryoturbation. I'm wondering if you've thought about sort of turbation from both the bio and the cryo end of things and how that connects.
Yes, I've thought about it a lot. I don't know if... We have a a way of looking at soils that we call process vector analysis. It's a fancy name, but it's very simple. And it means that in a soil, you can have major processes going on. Each has an expression. In cryoturbation and bioturbation, I would imagine, and I'm guessing here, but as you increase altitude or increase latitude, where you're getting more of the cryo effect, then that's going to offset the bio. In most parts of our planet, at least the continental parts, except the high latitudes and high altitudes, I think the bio is probably dominant. But it depends on the site and the situation. Incidentally, I wanted to ask you a question, if you will allow me. I would imagine, I've worked a lot in Mozambique, and we saw stone layers in every soil we sampled. And I would imagine they were there in Kruger, but you didn't mention it, so I just wondered.
Yeah, they don't pop up at my rainfall, but if you increase rainfall by 30 centimeters by moving to the western corner of the park, you find them at a meter down. Presumably, that's the whole biomantle.
So, Don, did I miss something? I can understand the bioturbation two layers, but what produces the mounds? Is there differential erosion that leads to the swales?
I can give you the current hypothesis.
Okay.
Those mounds, there are over 100 different theories on how these mounds form. If you Google Mima mounds, you'll see what I mean. We buy into the Dahlquist-Scheffer hypothesis. And their argument is that most of these mounds are produced by pocket gophers. There's 40 different species of these small vertebrates in North America, and they occur only in North America. Their behaviors are all quite different because they're different species, and species defines not only morphological differences, but also behavioral differences. These animals, their lifestyle is nest-centered. That is, they produce a nest, and then they do underground grazing outward from that nest center. And as they burrow outward, a little more soil goes back towards their nest center than goes the other way. So you fast forward 500 years, but I should tell you, a lot of people don't buy into that model, but we do. It's the only thing that explains Mima mounds in almost every state and all of the Canadian prairie provinces. It's this one animal. But we think they're polygenetic because many other processes impact those landforms. But that pocket gopher, we think, is dominant.
So just to follow up on Mike's question, if you imagine that resource availability might be related to the radius of the mounds,
I think you're right.
See a decrease in the radius, an increase in the radius as you move north?
That's what we concluded, that particular prairie is optimal, ideal, for food resources, availability of mound making material, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the only Mima mound field that we've seen that looks like that's so dramatic in its view. So it's sort of an end member of a spectrum. Yes?
Don, if you had a diagnostic horizon.
I'm sorry?
If you had some diagnostic horizon, RGF horizon, calcium horizon, that was overlying
I can give you an example of some of the Mima mounds in Louisiana, in the Calcasieu and Cameron parishes. You can see them on air photos. They're actually below high tidal range. You can see them in Lake Calcasieu, under the water. And also they're on the, they're subaerially exposed nearby. And those mounds have long since been abandoned, and so you get, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but you get good horizonation within the mounds. In other words, the mounds are fossil and soil formation, normal soil formation, has developed in the mounds, so you get an AEBT horizon forming because there's no dominant bioturbation by these animals. I don't know if that's what, if that's an answer to your question, Curtis.
One last question, Wayne.
Yeah, but those in Louisiana don't have a stone line.
No, no, in Texas and Louisiana, no stone layers because there's no, well, in all the places we've looked at most of what has been written about them, the soils are formed in fine fraction.
How would you differentiate between, let's say, a colluvial stone line or, say, a biostone line?
It's a good question. Fluvial stone lines are imbricated, so there's no problem there. But if it's close to the surface and the soil forms there, the imprecation could be lost. Most of the geologic stone lines that I've seen in the northern Midwest and glaciated terrains, they're imbricated. So they're not biologic.
But how would you differentiate?
With a lot of field work and a lot of work. And building an argument and a case, depending on your favorite hypothesis.
Do you think the stones were already rounded before the animals got here, or did the animals cause the roundness?
Well, in Africa, which is a stone layer continent, almost all the stones that I've seen in stone layers in Africa are rounded. But rounding can occur not only by abrasion, but also by solution. I mean, even silica. Silica goes into solution, so if you have a, and there's a lot of through flow in stone lines, which may be responsible for that, what do you call it, the seep line? Stone lines in Africa are very effective aquifers for through flow, and you get a lot of solution. So what looks to be a braided class in a stone line may actually be solutional rounding as a consequence.
All right, well, thank you very much, Don. Very good.